Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, before the show started, exciting. We were doing some TV commentary here. Canon and Kojak, and we'll get to Lou Grant shortly.
That's right.
Dr. Alan Sharchak is here, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, professor, political scientist, et cetera, et cetera.
How'd you do?
How'd you do yourself? And Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Kingston Daily Freeman in New York's Hudson Valley.
How do you suppose the listeners think when they hear us talking about Canon and Kojak and probably saying, who the heck were they
or
are they?
Dudes, yeah. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. The only good thing is that the demographic of the public radio audience.
And that, Rex Smith, is a problem. Because what happens is that, let's say you decide you're going to do something youthful. Well, the existing audience that you have might not like it.
Yeah.
So, for example, NPR clearly, I mean, I can only suggest why they're doing it as a kid or a young person reading the
Young woman who's now the voice.
So, yes, yeah. The underwriting announcements.
Yeah.
I don't like her. I mean, I don't like what it sounds like. I think it's silliness. But
you'd like that older guy with the nasal voice. This is NPR.
Yeah, that's the one I like.
It's the same thing in print. I mean, we just did a redesign, and one of the features of the redesign is page two has sort of a bunch of short hitter kinds of things and
like
pop
USA,
culture times.
USA Today.
And, you know, and some of the, and you're trying to be more modern, you're trying to attract some of the younger readers, but the older readers are calling and saying, what a waste of space. And
you know, a decade ago, many of the Gannett papers, at the time they had about 100 across the country, created weekly youth sections in one market after another, thinking that they could draw young readers this one day a week, and then they would make them into newspaper readers. Didn't work because the young people were not attracted to the format. They didn't like the newsprint. They didn't like what a newspaper represented, and it wasn't true to the texture of the product.
And they had already jumped over the whole
jumped the shark. Is that
the
shark. Term you're trying to say?
What, in TV, it's called jumping the shark.
Jumping the shark. Yeah, jumped over. And now they've got, you know, the cell phones and the computers and the Twitters and all the rest of that stuff. Now you
leapfrogged was the
leapfrogged.
Word you were looking for.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. Jump frog. Frog jump. Right. Also shows how old I am. So now, Rex, but you have fought the good fight. And every time we and I don't want to say allow you to because it's your show, but every time, every time you're on, you talk about training young people how to read newspapers, this newspaper education.
No, news literacy is about giving young people the tools to understand what journalism is, not necessarily to read newspapers. It's giving people the capacity to understand the difference between the journalism of verification, which, yes, we do practice in the legacy media, and the difference between that and propaganda, public relations, advertising. Raw data, so that they know when they're reading what neighborhood they're in, basically. Mm. Am I in the journalism neighborhood, or am I in the political propaganda?
I get it. And if you read the Post, you're always in all of them, POST. But I did want to ask you one thing. How's it going?
Oh, that or just in general, you know?
No, that.
It hurts
that.
When I do this.
That. How is that going?
Well, actually,
you see tremendous progress among the young people of the country understanding the issues of journalism.
In general, you're speaking not of the news literacy movement, but in the
talking about the news literacy.
Yeah. Well, the problem is the millennial generation is not increasing its news consumption. Over the last 8 years, there has been not a noticeable increase of time spent with news among millennials, even as they have aged a bit.
No, remind me, what is millennials?
They're like today's teenagers and 20s.
And they're called millennials because...
Well, because they're sort of coming of age around the turn of the
century.
Yeah,
I got you.
The youngest ones now are those born just before the turn of the century.
Gotcha.
Then above them is Generation X, then boomers,
and
then
boomers, right.
Above the boomers are the silent generation. So
what was I? Well, I was born in 41.
You know, well, I'm afraid you're silent.
Not here.
You're right at the end of the silent generation. Maybe that explains why he booms a bit.
So the whole business about verification, which your journalist practiced, Laura Logan didn't practice.
Well, there was a... Thank you
nice,
for that.
Nice, Ira!
That's really true.
I think we were going off the rails.
Yeah, well, CBS News has ordered an unspecified leave of absence for Laura Logan and her producer in the wake of the 60 Minutes story having to do with Benghazi. That basically relied upon a supposed British security contractor who said he was an eyewitness and, in fact, was nowhere near the American facility on the night of the attack. So it's
really too bad. It's a great tragedy because she's terrific. But mistakes were made.
Yes.
But, you know, it sort of pulls the curtain back from behind where 60 Minutes operates. It surprises me that even though the commentators on 60 Minutes are mostly veterans, certainly they were in the origins of Mike Wallace and, you know, that group, they're all excellent journalists. But we would have thought, or at least I would have, that there are many, many people are involved in getting a story on the air. And it seems from this case, from what we can determine, that Laura Logan, the on-air person and the chief producer are the ones who are being blamed for this, which suggests that they really drove the bus. There were not many people behind the scenes on this.
Well, can I give you an alternative theory, which was somebody had eat the pipe, you know, so you look around, was it the head guy who had to remove himself, or was it the executive producer of the program who had to do themselves? So what happens is when the ship is sinking and the rats are deserting the ship.
Well,
The question is, you know, who gets the blame? So,
well, why would you blame the executive producer? Why wouldn't you blame the people who created the story? The question in my mind is how much work a correspondent does when they front, the term is, when they front a story. And that's always been an interesting issue for 60 Minutes and for network television news.
So let me ask you a question, Rex. Suppose something really bad happens at your newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you can't just make a suppose. I mean, you have to have something specific. I would presume that 60 Minutes, a respected news organization, would have looked into, okay, who did what and when? Why wasn't something red flagged in the editing process and in the production? So it probably was, you know, pretty specifically directed at this particular producer whose name is McClellan, Max McClellan. And Logan apparently actually did work on the story. She didn't just sit there and read the script.
See, when I'm sitting up here, and if anything bad happens at the radio station, you know, somebody's going to point a finger at me.
Well,
but
I haven't noticed you quitting.
Well, now, Jeff Fager, who's the
CBS... nothing's ever happened.
Jeff Fager, who's the chairman of CBS News, is also the guy who succeeded Don Hewitt, is he not? And is he still involved with 60 Minutes? From what we know of the Don Hewitt era, because we saw all these behind-the-scenes stories, was that Hewitt screened all of the stories before they aired. He gave the third degree to the correspondents. Famously, Mike Wallace would have knocked down drag them outs, and they do roughly three stories a week. You mean to tell me that the head guy didn't see this particular story before it aired?
On the
60 Minutes. I mean, you know, I think your question to Rex is not a bad question, but I think that I would argue if there was a major story in the Times Union, the odds are good that Rex would have seen it before it was published. And if it was termed to be fatally flawed, Rex might have to take some heat from it because he okayed it. I don't know if that can happen at a newspaper on a daily basis with all of the content we have. 60 Minutes does three stories a week. And it would seem to me that somebody above the correspondent and the line producer should have looked at that story, and particularly a story like Benghazi, and it's a red flag.
But they didn't get. But your point is that nobody got punished above those two.
That's right. Yeah.
Who else fell at CBS News in the wake of the 60 Minutes 2? At the time it was called, a report on George W. Bush evading service. You know, that was really...
And that turned out to be wrong.
It turned out to be wrong. Well,
Dan Rather says not. That's wow. He says the story was true, but what? The
story was true, but the document they relied upon was not. That is the fundamental, the underlying piece of the story, which is that George W. Bush managed to avoid being called into the Vietnam War because of his political connections. He asserts that that it remains true, but they went on the air with a big to-do over a document that purported to make that point, and the document was a fraud.
Interesting.
And so who other than Dan Rather, I mean, that ultimately led to Dan Rather's departure from CBS. I don't remember who else actually got heat for that, but we tend to attribute it to the correspondence, to the face on the TV screen, even though we know that in network television news, the producers, and as I was suggesting, maybe the executive producer really should have a role there. Makes sense.
If we had a story at our newspaper that our editor had vetted and it proved to be a colossal disaster of a story, I can't imagine that we would only have sought action against the writer of the story or even the initial copy. Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, so CBS is taking heat for a story they aired that they shouldn't have. AP is getting a bit of attack for not writing a story that some people are suggesting they didn't write in attempting to not tick off the White House. That is the story about the Iran negotiations, John Kerry carrying on talks secretly, turns out long before a deal was concluded, a tentative deal to try to pull back some of the Iranian nuclear program. And the AP supposedly, now Howard Kurtz, whom we've quoted in this program a lot, Howard Kurtz used to write media for the Washington Post and he was on CNN. Now he's on Fox News. And he
says, I always suspected him.
You always suspect. He says, perhaps the wire service didn't want to tick off the administration by going with that story. And what the AP says is a tip is not a story. And this is often the case. People will accuse us of sitting on a story when, in fact, we just haven't confirmed it to our satisfaction.
Which is why the blogs have become so dangerous, because bloggers say anything and generally get away with it.
And it's also why I think AP is generally, although the conservative wing has been critical of AP, AP is a little bit more conservative. They're going to wait longer before they run a story because their story has such impact and it appears in so many places. They're not going to be cowboys on a story.
We tell our staff when they're blogging. We have an initiative to try to step up our breaking news reporting for the web. We want people to understand that if they want breaking news, they can go to timesunion.com. They can look at the new mobile site because mobile is now so much bigger than it was just a year ago.
Huge.
Because everybody's getting these smartphones. We've really tried to make the point, Alan, to what you were saying about bloggers saying anything. We want you to file quickly. We want you to be right on top of breaking news, but you can't say more than you know. And if you'll look at experiences like the Boston Marathon, when you go forward with tips or rumors, you can get in trouble. You can do a real disservice to the public. So we want you to be on top of breaking news. And actually, commercial radio, which has always had these newscasts at the top and the bottom of the hour, is good training for that because these guys have to rewrite their stories and try to make it sound fresh when they don't necessarily have anything new, but they don't dare go on the air with something that they don't know. For us, we've always had the great luxury of waiting until evening to write the story, get as much as you can and then write. Now we're facing constant deadlines, and it's a new muscle for us to exercise in the newspaper business.
A couple of things. Number one, I think it's much harder to be a reporter now than it used to be, simply because of all the things you've just raised. Secondly, I wonder how often people get caught for something that may not be journalistically appropriate. So, for example, this very morning as we sit here and do this show, I had done a commentary that was played later that basically said, it's too bad about the Thanksgiving Day parade and the fact that if the wind is more than 23 miles an hour, whatever it was, you can't use the balloons. Kids will be disappointed in the rest of it. And I said, and that seems to me to be the right move because the handlers have lots of trouble holding on and they can get hurt and the balloons can bust into a building. And then I turned on NPR and NPR said, the reason that they don't blow up the balloons over 23 miles an hour is because they can't inflate them when the wind is on. And that didn't sound right to me because I remember when there was all kinds of problems. Well, I wonder if anybody has called them and said, what do you mean by that?
No, and that is wrong because they always inflate the balloons the night before. So the decision is made whether or not they're going to fly the balloons the next morning.
Hey, here's an interesting thing. On the front page of the Chattanooga Times Free Press, now there's a great name. It's because, you know, newspapers have merged over the time, and so three newspapers have become one or two, something like that. Anyway, they did something factual, but they're getting a lot of grief for it, and it's an interesting controversy. So there are 32 people arrested in a federal investigation of the city's crack trade, and they put the mugshots on the front page of all 32 of those people. All the suspects are men. All of them are black. And so now there's a protest about the Chattanooga Times Free Press for what is, in fact, viewed by some people as being a racist attack. That is, putting forth the notion that all criminals are black is one of the messages that is presented by this, by running 32 mugshots of all black men on the front page. What do you think about that?
The only question I would have about it is, how often do they run the mugshots of other people who are arrested or large-scale arrests? I think that there's nothing wrong with running pictures of mugshots of this type, regardless of what the color of the suspects is. So, you know, when you hear Chattanooga, you immediately think, well, there must be some sort of a racist motivation. I don't know that that's the case. I hope it's not the case. But running pictures of people who are arrested makes sense to me. I wish our newspaper did more of it.
There's a sociological approach to this, too, Rex, if you don't mind my getting a little academic here. And that is that our prisons are disproportionately filled with people. And I say disproportionately, I mean it. You know, we're not that far from slavery, although there'll be people moaning when I say that. We have made an oppressed class in this country. There's a certain amount of criminality that happens out of desperation. And therefore, you know, the guy smoking pot on the 16th floor of his Park Avenue apartment building is not likely to get arrested nearly as much as the guy who's smoking under a lamppost somewhere. So if you take a look at the larger picture, it is not surprising that there are black mugshots on the front of the paper, but if you take a look at the societal issues, you should have more concerns.
Yeah, I'm going to take the other side of it and say that I think that the newspaper needs to think about the message that it conveys, even if it is factual that all 32 of the suspects were African American. The message that it conveys by doing that is that all African-American men are to be feared. I think it just that you have to think about the impact on society. I think that's somewhat what you're saying, Alan, when you do this kind of thing, that even though the facts are as depicted by the newspaper, depicting it visually that way is not a good thing for the community.
So I'd like to respond to that and perhaps take a different side, Rex. We've duked this out a lot. The minute you decide that you don't want to visualize things the way that they appear to be, you're editorializing. So in other words, if you don't run those pictures because of what you just said, and I admire what you said, you may change the course of history, which the newspapers are, and therefore you do that. And for example, nobody ever says what I just said about the sociological implications of why people of color are oppressed in this country, just because you were trying in your liberal, and I say that respectfully, to avoid typecasting.
It is true that we make judgments that ultimately change the perception of things. And we do that all the time. You know, is this newsworthy? Is this more newsworthy? But this is one of those situations where it seems to me that there's more damage done by the bald recitation of facts visually than there is by the sort of more conservative approach that I would think of that I'm taking.
But Rex, hold on a second. Mm-hmm. You'll never know. I mean, my favorite book is Time and Again, which is a wonderful book about a guy who goes back in history. And the whole thing revolves around the fact that at one point he just rubs up against somebody and delays them. And that's the end.
Yeah.
That's the end of the book. So when you do what you're saying is a good thing, and it sounds like a good thing, you may be screwing things up
you
for
never
the rest
know.
Of history.
Back in 2002, the Philadelphia Daily News did a front page that was entirely filled with 18 police mugshots of fugitive wanted for murder by the Philadelphia police. All 18 were African-American, Hispanic, or Asian. And the son of Philadelphia's mayor at the time, a man named Sharif Street, said that that front page damages the quality of life for the average male my age, he said, because it portrays us as the enemy of society. So, well, the guy who's now the editor of the Philadelphia Daily News, Michael Days, who was then the managing editor, said, sometimes we're guilty of tunnel vision. The visual impact of all those black men accused of crimes, well, you can imagine the message that sends, said Michael Days.
And the visual impact, he would argue, and I guess you would argue, is greater than reading the names in the paper, even if the names of the paper might suggest what race they are?
I think so. Yeah, I think that visual, because the photographs tell a story so powerfully that I think it does. But, you know, I think it's a really tough issue. I can see the point of view that we risk something, too, as Alan is saying, by making these judgments.
It's the son of the mayor. Well, on the other hand, just by putting the pictures in, you're also making a different kind of decision.
Yeah.
But the son of the mayor, it seems to me, is right. I mean, this country is rife with racial prejudice. And if somebody walks down a street and you see a big black man or a big white man coming, we know from studies and other things that who goes out into the middle of the street, you know, as a result of that. And I think that the mayor's son, then mayor's son, had a point.
Wait a minute. If he's right, then I'm right, and you were disagreeing with me from my point of view.
Well, I always try to disagree with you. That's my job here.
He switched.
On the one hand, on the other hand.
On the other hand. Speaking of the power of photographs, photographs, I say, there is a protest at the White House, a protest of what's going on at the White House by major news organizations. Many major news organizations have written, 37 news organizations, including groups that I'm a member of, the American Society of News Editors, various journalism organizations, protesting the fact that the White House increasingly is excluding photographers from events that they used to cover.
How come?
Instead, they're letting a White House staff photographer take a picture, and then they're releasing that picture so that there are fewer photographers, fewer sort of unplanned moments. This way, the White House controls the visual image that comes out of an event.
As my mom would say, they're all doing that now. I mean, governors have been known to do it. Governors right around here have been known to do it.
Who do you think?
So the whole idea is to gain an advantage. And you're right to bring it up, and so is the press, to bring it up to just sort of put a stop to it.
So the White House says it's just logistics, that you can't give photographers access to all kinds of things.
Maybe get a picture of the president smoking.
Yeah, well, you can't get that. He says he hasn't now in 6 years. He says he's afraid of Michelle. And so he says he hasn't had a smoke.
But this is just, you know, it's such a disappointment. You know, as we go along in this administration, many of us who had high hopes for this president, and he's fulfilled some of those high hopes. But certain issues such as this, which is an open and free and unfettered press, and if you recall that press conference many months ago where his spokesman used the word unfettered press dozens of times, I mean, this is something that has historically been part of our country, that an independent press comes in and captures history as the independent photographers see it, not as the president sees it. And this is just it's disappointing, and I think the public should realize that this is not just a press issue. This is their issue.
Right. It's not to say the president shouldn't have private moments. Surely there should be plenty of times when there shouldn't be any photographers around. It is to say that when there are public things going on, the example that was cited is when the president went for a swim off Panama City, Florida in 2010 to demonstrate that the water had been cleaned up after the BP oil spill. They didn't allow press photographers there, but they issued a White House photograph showing him swimming. They made this a public event. This is the president saying, oh, the water's clean. We've taken care of this.
Or how about the kiss between Tipper and Al? The famous kiss.
Well, that was at the convention. What about? But I was going to say.
No, but the question is, was that planned?
Oh.
But Hillary, somehow it went around the world.
You recall Hillary and Bill dancing in the beach.
I knew, when their marriage had been in trouble. Do you think that was?
It was a stage, but at least it was taken by professional independent photographers.
Lurking in the shrubbery, I believe, 100 yards away.
And you never know, who may have been alerted to the potential for this.
Don't you think?
Yeah. But look at all that. We just went through the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, and look at all the films of the Kennedys and at home, or him coming off of the plane and being greeted by the family. They were taken by independent people capturing history. It's just a piece of...
You guys always make such good arguments for whatever you want.
That's why we're here. We don't take two sides.
That's right. All right. Well, if you want to join the conversation, media@wamc.org is how you write to us. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, Rex Smith, and you can talk back. We're fine. We're fine with that. We're not sensitive. Thanks for joining us
not
on
much.
Media Project.
See, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ding-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
It must have startled poor old Sadie's Unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. Or I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers, plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh,